So Stuart said, I'm speaking about moduli stabilization and Suzy breaking within the context of the heterotic orbifold models. This is work with my advisor, Stuart, and Alex Westfall from Stanford University, who's not here, so we can talk about him. In this talk, I'll briefly review what effective field theories look like from the orbifold compactifications and stabilizing moduli and anti-de Sitter minima, which is sort of a well-addressed problem. Then I want to talk in some detail about a simple model that we found, which you can stabilize all the moduli of the heterotic compactifications in, a nearly Minkowski vacua. And then, of course, at the end, I want to talk about some low energy physics. And this is the piece that I'm most interested in. So typically, you're breaking in heterotic orbifold models. You start with something big like E8 cross E8, and you end up with the MSSM. The MSSM has rank 4, but E8 cross E8 has rank 16. That means we get a lot of extra stuff. Typically, what happens is we end up with lots of non-abelian singlets. This is, you can sort of see this because the adjoint representation of E8 cross E8 is 248 dimensional, and the representation of the stuff in the standard model is nowhere near 248 dimensional, so you end up with a lot of stuff left over from the, at least just from the adjoint representation. You also, the physics of this arrow is actually very important, so the orbifold that we compactify on has fixed points, and around these fixed points live certain twisted sector states, so those also pop up in the low energy physics, and those tend to be singlets, but they don't necessarily have to be. Also, we typically end up with lots of U1s, and of those multiplicity of U1s, typically you can define one that is anomalous. All of them have a little bit of anomaly. You can find a basis where you sort of rotate all the anomaly into one U1, and this anomaly is canceled by a Green-Schwarz mechanism, which Keith tells us is still consistent. Superpotential is specified to all order by the string selection rules. So there's essentially all the fields in the model. The superpotential tells you how they interact in the low energy theory. Specifically, the model that I want to focus on to be concrete is called the Mini Landscape Model 1. This is a model written down by Stuart and several Germans, several people from Germany at least, in 2007. So these models are very good, have very good low energy phenomenology. So, you know, good hypercharge MSSM spectrum, the exotics decouple, F equal to D equal to zero solutions exist, heavy top. And then we showed in 2008 how you can accommodate gauge coupling unification within the context of these models. But, you know, this is a large number of phenomenological hurdles that hadn't previously existed in the literature. Also, I should say, these models also, which I didn't write here, but I probably should have, these models have a good R symmetry, a good R parity, two different things, have a good R parity, which also is sort of exceptional for string models. So these models are compactification on a T6 mod Z6-2 orbifold. It's not very important what that means, but Z6-2 basically tells you what the tori look like on the complex plane. And so I want to use this model. I want to use this model as an example in what follows. So this model is, in some sense, typical. This hidden sector gauge group, SU4, so this is a paper by Stuart and the six authors that appeared in PRL. Of the 77 total models that turned up in the mini landscape search, something like 50% of them had an SU4 gauge group, and something like 90% of them had SU4 or larger gauge group in the hidden sector. So when we want to try to motivate moduli stabilization supersymmetry breaking, we want to try to do it coming as close to possible as sort of the norm of these models. And this is certainly, this model is sort of a good example, or sort of an average example of what we expect to see in this. So certainly other string constructions tend to have hidden sector gauge groups of large rank as well. So this is from a paper by Keith and I guess one of his graduate students at the time. QCDs in the hidden sector of large rank seem to be pretty typical. And so something like, in their search, it looks like 50% of the models have something that's SU4 or larger in the hidden sector. So these hidden sector Suzy QCDs tend to be pretty common in these in the heterotic string compactifications. So I think these were within the context of free fermionic constructions. So in our heterotic models, the moduli that we end up with are the dilaton S. There's two Kähler moduli, T and U, not two typically order a couple, T and U moduli, which parameterize the shape of the compact dimensions. There's also a bunch of other singlets, including blow-up modes, which sort of tell you how to get rid of, how to resolve the singularities of the orbital fold. And a lot of these other MSSM singlets, which tell you interesting things about Yukawa coupling. And so in the paper, we explain how to stabilize all of these, and I'll have something to say, have a little bit to say about that. So the dilaton is basically tells you the coupling constant, the gut coupling constant, in order to get good gauge coupling unification, which by virtue of my advisor, I'm very interested in. In order to get good gauge coupling unification, we need to find the dilaton has to be of order 2 in Planck units. So if you just rely on Suzy breaking effects to stabilize the dilaton, there's no way that we can get realistic gauge coupling. Or you have to live with Planck scale Suzy breaking. So the geometric moduli that I'll talk about in the heterotic compactifications, the T and U moduli, so you can basically look at a torus as a lattice in the complex plane, et cetera, et cetera. You can define T and U moduli in terms of the lengths of the legs and the angle between the legs in the complex plane. And then when you realize that going around the torus makes you end up in the same place, this is what leads to this sort of modular invariance, this SL2Z. So this the important thing that I wanted to say, though, is that this modular invariance is inherited by the superpotential, and the superpotential has to transform under this SL2Z symmetry, which gives it a very specific dependence on the T and U moduli. I didn't put the U moduli here, but they enter in the same manner. And so this is an important concept, that this superpotential inherits this modular, this symmetry from the UV physics. And one thing that hasn't really been addressed in the literature, except in this paper by Love and Todd, that's not necessarily SL2Z symmetries, which the superpotential has to be invariant under. It can be subgroups of SL2Z, discrete subgroups, and those are sort of interesting to think about. You end up with some interesting structures. So basically, the raw materials that I want to work with, sort of the ingredients that I want to limit myself to, are one or more hidden, one or more QCD-like theories in the hidden sector. So typically one, but possibly more. Certainly, the model that I'm going to talk about has only one QCD in the hidden sector. But if you're willing to consider more, you may limit the amount of models that you're looking at. But you can consider more models, and you can have something like a racetrack, and certainly people have done that before. We end up with tons of singlets. We end up with tons of U1s, and possibly one of them is anomalous. Probably one of them is anomalous. Most likely one of them is anomalous. F equal to D equal to zero solutions exist in the global Suzy limit. And I put F equal to D equal to W equal to zero because the mini landscape, the vacua that were studied in the mini landscape paper, all obey this property. And so this is in the limit where S and T dependence of the superpotential is not considered. Modular invariance of the superpotential dictates the T and U dependence of the superpotential, and the dilaton VEV sets the gauge coupling. So these are the sort of the things that I want to include. So let me say something now about stabilizing the moduli in these compactifications. So it's stabilizing the dilaton is... It's pretty easy to see how to do that. This is, for example, the well-cited paper by KKLT. You can imagine having some QCD becoming strongly coupled, and if you add to that superpotential a small constant W naught, generated by, say, fluxes or something, you can get a non-trivial minimum for the dilaton S. So the problem, of course, is that you can set W naught by hand or anthropically, if you like, but W naught more or less sets the scale of the superpotential, which sets the gravitino mass. And so this is, if you're setting W naught by hand, you're essentially setting all of the scale of low-energy physics by hand, and so you have to be careful about that. The other thing is that this is stabilization and anti-de Sitter minimum. Certainly we observe the cosmological constant not to be large and negative, so we'd like to try to model, to build a model that doesn't have a large and negative cosmological constant. So the question about stabilizing T and U moduli was addressed by this paper in Font, Avanias, Lust, and Quevedo, 1992. This is a sort of a very nice paper, I think. So under just very general considerations, you say, well, you know, suppose I have some condensing gauge group, and suppose I have some constant W naught. I don't know where W naught comes from, but that's okay. I have some condensing gauge group. This generates some potential for the dilaton. And I know that this superpotential has to transform with very specific properties. So I don't know where W naught comes from, so let me assume that it's inert under the modular transformations, and let's assume that the gauge condensate is inert under modular transformations, and this implies a very specific form of the superpotential. So you can get this transformation properties of W with a Dedekind eta function. And so this is sort of, so then you can, you know, you can turn the supergravity crank and see what comes out. And this is the sort of the potential that comes out in the t direction, the real t and the imaginary t. And this is sort of a really nice thing because it goes to infinity as t goes to infinity, and it goes to infinity as t goes to zero. So in some sense, the theory here is forced to be compactified. There's no solutions if you assume that this is a superpotential. You never find a decompactified theory. There's no runaway t goes to infinity sort of minimum. And so you find, you turn a crank and you find that the minimum of t is always around 1.23. And, you know, the statement in the paper is that the VEF of t is always near the self-dual point of the eta function. So it's not, the self-dual point is actually a saddle point. But so very close by is actually a minimum of the potential. So this is sort of a claim that persists. Sorry? Mm-hmm. No. So that you're right. So I'm certainly not considering any loop corrections. And so what you're talking about is that the gauge kinetic function F is a function of the eta function and the dilaton. So to loop level, it goes like S plus 1 over 4 pi times log of the eta function squared or something. So you can certainly include those loop corrections, but that's not what I'm talking about here. Those loop corrections come, those are loop corrections to the gauge kinetic function. And this is just the sort of the dependence of the T modulus that comes here. I'm not. But okay. So you certainly can consider loop corrections to this statement.
I think that's exactly what you're doing, but you're doing it from a more generic point of view. You're just saying that if you just take into account what the symmetries of this theory are, then you have to get something like an eta function of the nature.
Okay. So the genesis of the eta function, I guess we can debate here, but I mean, this is the form of the potential. But the eta function comes as a log in the exponent. So anyway, this is the t dependence in this Font, Abanias, Lust, Quevedo thing. So the eta function comes from loop correction, say. Yeah. Okay. So that's the. I agree. This is an assumption. I agree. So this is 1992. The motivation here is to show that people have looked at this problem before, and there's no reason to expect, as you probably know, you can anticipate. There's no reason to expect that W naught and the gauge Gaugino condensate transform with the same modular weight. There's no reason to expect that. And so it's sort of an ad hoc assumption. We don't know where this W naught's going to come from, they say, and so I'm just going to write it down and assume this. So the problem is that this minimum also is always anti-de-Sitter. So if you can compute the vacuum energy as a ratio of the gravitational mass, you end up with something that's always near negative one. Absolutely. So your paper is, yeah, so I read that paper as well. And you're definitely right that you can have something more general here than the Dedekind eta function. That's definitely right. So again, I'm just trying to show that this is a problem that has been addressed in the literature in the past. So the good news and the bad news is that, the good news is that we can stabilize the dilaton S, and we can stabilize the T and U moduli with modular dependence. But the bad news is that we always end up in anti-de-Sitter vacua. And so I want to show now a model which Stuart and Alex and I have written down that this is not the case. So the gauge group here is SU5 cross U1A. This is an anomalous U1. So the quarks, we have a couple of quark flavors, Q and Q tilde. These are the charges under the U1A. These aren't particularly nice charges, but I can say that I found a few models where we're not so attached to these charges, I guess. Anyway, for definiteness, though, let's write down some charges so we can include two moduli S and T. The Kähler potential looks like the typical heterotic thing, log S plus S bar, log T plus T bar. So this for the moduli. For the other singlet fields, all enter in the same way. T plus T bar to some power n. This n is called the modular weight, and is something that's given to us by the orbifold. So we have no modular dependence in phi initially, but you can check. I've checked in some examples that changing this n to something other than zero doesn't greatly affect what we end up with. And the superpotential I'm going to talk some more about is the sum of three parts: a non-perturbative piece, a singlet piece, and a W naught. So to generate the non-perturbative piece, you just imagine having some some Suzy QCD theory that has some mass terms, and these mass terms depend on phi and the modulus T. And so you can play the normal game of assuming that these mass terms are large and integrating them out. And what you end up with, the theory generates some scale, a la Alphac, Dine, and Seiberg. And so you can play the normal game of integrating things out, and you end up with some non-perturbative superpotential, which looks like this. Again, this T dependence, which I messed up. There should be a T here, gamma T times T. So this gamma T times T pi over 12 comes from just expanding the eta function out. So the singlet superpotential looks like this. If you'll, given the charges, this is the gauge invariant thing that we can write down. So then you can examine the superpotential in the global limit, and you see that there's a supersymmetric vacuum where d equal to 0. And this vacuum doesn't depend on the VEV of phi 2. It's arbitrary. And the other thing to note is that in this vacuum, the singlet superpotential equals to 0. There's also an FID term from the anomalous U1. This FID term essentially sticks the value, the VEV of phi 2 in place. So now the VEV of phi 2 is no longer arbitrary, but this vacuum now satisfies F equal to D equal to 0, which is one of the things that I wanted, one of the criteria that I wanted to satisfy. So let's look at what we have done so far. We have a Suzy QCD in the hidden sector, an anomalous U1, superpotential, and an FID term such that F equal to D equal to 0 solutions exist, and W equals 0 in the non-perturbative limit. So now I want to say briefly about generating W naught. Generating W naught, so the singlet superpotential has a discrete R symmetry. And you can see this by assigning chi R charge equal to 2, and phi 1 and phi 2 both R charge equal to 0. But it turns out that if you are dealing with any realistic heterotic string construction, you'll get higher dimensional operators at some point in the string selection rule, which spoil this. And what you can show is shown in this paper, which is another very nice short paper. You can actually generate this constant W naught from this explicitly broken R symmetry. And I won't say anything about this, but if you don't believe me, we can look at the paper and I can show you the argument is, you know, a couple of lines long. But from explicitly broken R symmetries, you could generate this small constant W naught. Now the question is, where does this W naught come from? Well, this W naught comes from a bunch of singlet VEVs multiplied together. So in the same way that you might expect, in the same way you might expect the Frogat-Nielsen mechanism to suppress, the upquark Yukawa coupling. So in the Frogat-Nielsen mechanism, you generate Yukawa couplings with high powers of singlet VEVs. And so you have something similar here. In principle, this W naught is some order 10 number of singlet VEVs multiplied to each other. If each of those singlet VEVs have a VEV of a tenth in Planck units or string units, then you get the suppression. And you can generate something that's dynamically that's suppressed relative to the largest scale in the problem. So again, from the low energy physics point of view, what we're doing is just dictating that the gravitino mass should be some high power of singlets below the string scale. So again, this gives us motivation for considering small numbers here, W naught. But that being said, we haven't put in 15 different singlet fields into Mathematica and tried to minimize the potential. So now let me say about the specific model. Let me say about some specific numbers, rather. So if you put in this superpotential as follows, and you find some range of parameters which gives you a minimum, you can put these numbers in. And if you want, I can send you the Mathematica notebooks. You can minimize the potential, and you can see that all the moduli in our superpotential, all these singlet fields get VEVs. So chi and phi 1 get VEVs at 0, and they stay at 0 even after Suzy breaking. Phi 2 gets stabilized at a VEV mostly set by the D term. S and T both get minimized near 2, and sigma, which is the axion in the S direction, gets minimized at 1. So you can change this plus sign. My arms aren't long enough, but you can change the plus sign to a minus sign here, and then sigma gets stabilized at 0. So sigma essentially sets the difference in sign between the two terms. And then you can check, and this is actually one of the things that Alex did, is you can check that all of the other singlets are stabilized after Suzy breaking. Under very general considerations, how the different singlets, all the different singlets in the superpotential enter, and you can look at how they enter and the many different ways that they enter, and you can see that they all get stabilized either at a very high scale or at a very low scale. Yeah? Do you have a question? Party? Pardon? High means at the string scale, actually. Low means 0 or less. I mean, it depends on, low means could mean at the weak scale, yeah. Below. And the other thing that I want to point out is that the Suzy breaking here is mostly from the T. So FT does most of the Suzy breaking. And the other thing that I want to point out, I did too many transitions here, is that this VEV of T is not equal to 1.234 blah, 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 which is sometimes people in papers, sometimes they wave their hands and say, well, you can always stabilize things near the self-dual minimum, but that's not always the case. And it definitely very much depends on the numbers B2 and B in the superpotential. So what we have is sort of an interesting potential in the S direction and the T direction. So for B greater than 0, both in the S and the T direction, both of them have this the same sort of shape. There's a definite minimum at some value, and then there's some runaway minimum as T goes to infinity, or S goes to infinity. Another interesting thing is that the dilaton really sees something that looks like KKLT. So if you set T to a constant, if you set T to its VEV, and look at this superpotential, it really looks like something that's KKLT. Likewise, if you set S to its VEV and look at this potential, it really looks you see what T sees. T sees basically a racetrack. So it's some sort of hybrid racetrack KKLT potential that we have. That's a good question. I guess it's a question of the scale. So let's see. So 5 times 10 to the negative 32 is here on this one. So I guess it must be some numerical garbage I'm getting. But yeah, so I'm sorry. I know these plots came from the same figure, so I'll have to, that's a good question. So as Constantine pointed out, though, you see that our vacuum energy here is slightly negative. This is not something that I didn't make a slide for this, but essentially what happens is you have a one-loop correction coming from Coleman-Weinberg-type calculation. So if you calculate the one-loop Coleman-Weinberg potential, what you find is there's a piece that diverges like lambda to the fourth, and that piece which diverges like lambda to the fourth gets enhanced by multiplying the number of fields in the theory. So it diverges like lambda squared. You're right, sorry. I'll write it so half of you can see it over here. So the one loop potential looks something like this, and then I'll come here and write it so the other half of you can see it. Uh, So the one loop potential looks something like this. You have a piece that goes like lambda squared times m3 half squared. And it turns out if you actually do this calculation, you get an enhancement by the number of multiplets in the theory. And for us, we have tons and tons of multiplets in the theory, which can give us some enhancement here. And it turns out that if you just plug numbers in, if you let lambda equal the string scale, and you put the gravitino mass in at about TeV, and you put the factors of 16 pi squared in, and you put the number of tensor multiplets to order 100, then you end up getting something that'll give you this last little bit of uplifting, so you can end up in a Minkowski vacuum. And this is in a paper by Ferrara, Kunis, Werner, and somebody else from 1992. So if you're concerned about the fact that this isn't exactly zero, well, we still have a little bit of uplifting that we didn't include here. So. Uh-huh. Pardon? Yeah. from the string theory side, I mean. So I just put in these values. In principle, you can get it from modular invariance, and then you can try to, you know, if you want to say, okay, well, let's include the one loop correction and blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, in general, you can compute B.
Why does it correct supersymmetry?
Because the F terms are non-zero. Is there an easy way to see it? So let's let me think about it. Let's see, the easiest way to see it. Yeah, so this is actually a good question. So I chose this case specifically. In this case specifically, the D breaking is much smaller, but it happens that that's not always the case. Sometimes the D breaking is bigger. And then in that case, what we have to do is consider a one loop correction for the field phi 2. And if you consider one loop correction for a certain range of the parameters in the superpotential, you can show that it forces the VEV of phi 2 in the other way. So I have a couple of slides that I prepared for that, but I took out because I wasn't sure how long I would ramble. So if you're interested, and I completely didn't look at what time I started, but I can show you a little bit about that in another example. So now I'm interested now in low energy observables, and I have hopelessly butchered Pierre Benetrouille's name, it looks like. But you can derive the soft masses, and this has been done in lots of places. Then you can use some program like SoftSUSY 3.1 to do the running to the weak scale. And then you can check a ton of other observables using this program, Micromegas 2.1. And between Mathematica and the Lehouche Accords, this is very easy to do. There's actually a command in Mathematica that you can call the command prompt in Linux, which is very nice. So now if we look at Mini Landscape 1 as an example, so if I am talking too long, then wave at me and I'll hurry up. Using Mini Landscape 1 as an example, we can look at the matter content of this theory. So what we have is these QA, these are the charges under the anomalous U1 here, and these are the modular weights of the different fields. You can see there's a couple of things that I should point out. One thing that I didn't say is that the Mini Landscape 1 has a discrete symmetry between the first two families. So one of the implications of this is that the modular weights are the same. So this helps a lot whenever you're thinking about flavor-changing neutral currents and stuff. And then you can also see that the first two families come from some. You can see the first two families come from a 5 bar plus 10 of SU5, given their QA charges. The third family comes from someplace that's slightly different. There's a lot of interesting physics in this model, and you probably know much. You guys know, can talk more about that, I guess. So then the idea is that we'll assume that. So in our compactification, there are typically 3 T moduli. So in order to get an idea of the numbers that I get out of this thing, I want to assume that the SUSY breaking is dominated by T3. and that the other two sort of maintain their no-scale structure. So this isn't wholly realistic, but in order to get an idea of the numbers that I get out, this isn't such a bad assumption. So the low energy observables, the gravitino mass in this specific example I showed you is about a TeV. The Gugino masses are given mostly by the dilaton F term. So if you notice, the F term of the dilaton was suppressed relative to T, so we have end up with light Gugino's. The A terms are non-universal, and at least for these two guys, we have to make some assumptions about the form of the coupling between the bottom quark and the down Higgs and the leptons and the down Higgs in the third family. So I have to make some assumptions here, but this is typically what we get out. So if you look at the high scale, these are the scalar masses. You can see the Higgses are about the same, but if you notice from the slide before, they had different charges under the U1A, so this is what gives the slight splitting in their masses. Likewise, between the generation 1 and 2 fermions and generation 3 scalar masses, the slight splitting is given exactly by the D term, contribution to the soft masses. So then you can use soft SUSY and do the running down, and this is the low energy spectrum. So most of these numbers probably aren't very interesting, but there's a few of them that I want to point out. the Higgs mass here is very light. Depending on how seriously you take the bound at LEP, whether or not you include a 1 sigma deviation there, you may think that it's already excluded. Another thing that's interesting is that this model has a very limited range of tan beta where it works for. So if you scan over the parameter space in tan beta, you find that it only works from about 25 to about 32. Yeah? It's an input. So these up here are inputs, that top thing. So I tell soft SUSY what I want tan beta to be, and I tell soft SUSY what I want the sine of the mu turn to be, and soft SUSY will tell me everything else. So the neutralino is mostly Beano, and it's about 100 GeV. And there's something else interesting, is it has a very light stop quark. The stop quark mass is about 115 GeV. So this small gap between the stop quark and the neutralino mass is pretty interesting. And actually, if you use soft SUSY, I didn't put this number here, but if you use soft SUSY to compute the relic density of our WIMP, you find that it's not as big as you would expect by a factor of 10 to the 2 or something. And actually, if you use Micromegas to compute the relic density, you find that it's lower than the WMAP number by a factor of 10 or so. So we don't get enough Beano dark matter, which is usually the opposite problem you have. So you can look at the other predictions from this range of parameters. In conclusion, the major obstacle to the Hedderach orbifold compactifications is a moduli stabilization problem. Certainly, there's very realistic examples of MSSMs coming from heterotic strings, and typically these models were abandoned a long time ago because of this problem of moduli stabilization. But we've shown that under some very general considerations, we can at least attempt to address this problem, and maybe it's not such a bad problem. Maybe the solution is really there. And there's some very interesting low energy physics which is associated with these guys, and it would be interesting to see what the parameter space of the SUSY breaking looks like and what kind of cosmology we get. So in particular, this lightest moduli, so MLMM is the lightest moduli mass, and this is the next lightest moduli mass, but this guy's pretty light, so probably we'll have some problems with getting realistic cosmology out, but it'd be interesting to see what it looks like. So, any questions? I forget. I think it's. Do you remember? I think it's mostly T. It's mostly T. It's the Kaler guy. So.